order, and we'll start working as soon as I get some people. But schedule change 2001, the redistricting. I'm going to hold that over. I still want us to keep working. I don't want to quite give up on it just yet. We got a little bit of time, day or two. So, you know, it's kind of like selling your daughter in the slave market. I'm not quite ready to take that step. I want to give this a day or so, Senator Brown, to work on it. 620 is not your father's 620. It's been gutting stuff by Senator Beyer to, and this will be a good one. This will be okay. So no panic about 620. 2010, we're still talking, so we'll hold 2010 over. And 3684, there's some conflict amendments, so we won't get to 3684 today. So if you're here solely for those four, go ahead and take the afternoon off. And when we get a couple more people, we'll get rolling here.
Should I put some
committee
hearing in while we wait
for
other people? Or do you want?
I don't really have any.
Any public hearings you can start?
Oh. You want to reset? I don't have any hearings, so we're just going to hear only. So we just wait. Because we got, you know, we got that other committee going.
We got what other committee?
Other radon committees going. John and Peter are both on that one.
Yeah.
Don't get too far away.
Do you want me to go to Ways and Means and then call me when someone else comes?
Sure. Let's see, I got you and Randy in Ways and Means right now.
I'm with Randy.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you're way down there. That's the only problem. And you've got Peter and John. So where's Jason and Lee?
Jason and Lee. Well, you go ahead and go to Ways and
okay.
Means, and know if I can't get a form.
Okay.
I can't get a form.
Hi, Roger. I didn't like your bill anyway.
I guess
yeah. I'll open the public hearing on 620. Because I don't have any. Okay. All right. All right, we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 620. We have some testimony.
Give it anyway.
Go find
Jason. That's the guy that doesn't have anything to do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer, State Senator, District 15. With me is Pat Eldon, and I guess John doesn't want to come up?
I guess not.
Okay. resident of Detroit, Oregon. As you know, by the Senate memorial that you passed out earlier this week and will be on the floor today, the situation is happening in Detroit. Before you are the -3 amendments to Senate Bill 620, which somewhat changed the bill. We've gotten stuff it. Anyway. They say that the Water Resources Department, who makes a recommendation to the Corps every year on the management of the project, the Willamette projects, the 11 reservoirs in the Willamette Basin, and in that recommendation, they shall keep Detroit Lake as the number one recreational reservoir, and if they hear back from the Corps that isn't going to happen, they shall hold a public hearing in the affected communities. I've talked with the Water Resources Department about this amendment this morning, and they have agreed that they won't come in and try to shoot it down here as long as I'm willing to make a couple changes when it gets to the House. We need to change public hearing to public meeting so they don't have the 30-day notice requirements and things like that that require in a public hearing, so it's more an informational meeting. And they would like to have the unallocated waters of the lake so that, because currently there are contract rights for irrigators who have some of the water of the lake, and they would like that to be unallocated water. So we will make those changes in the House side if we move this bill forward today. Mm-hmm. With me is Pat Eldon, and she has submitted a letter that to me that you have at your desk, and she may want to say a few words also.
I would just like to thank all of you in the Senate for all of your support and concern about this area, as it is being very detrimental to the business people in Detroit, and we all appreciate your support.
Thank you, Pat. I may or may not know, I'm from Klamath, and we're having the same struggle. We're not, in the current climate, not able to work together and have everybody share equally. They're going to one major source, and that's you know, I think we could do a little bit better job of working together on it, so.
We realize that, but we'd also like to declare that we don't have the sucker fish either.
Yeah. Okay, any further discussion, committee on the memorial?
Or the bill.
Whatever this is called, the bill. Okay. Any objection with those provision? We'll get those fixes over there. Okay, hearing none, so order. Senator Beyer will be the carrier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, does that mean you represent Brighton Bush?
Correct.
I do.
You get to go free then?
620.
Which Senator Beyer? Mr. Chair.
Senator,
which Senator Beyer is carrying?
Senator R. Beyer.
Thank you.
I wanted clarification with what we just did. Did we adopt the...
Yeah, we just adopted the dash threes. Hearing none, so ordered.
Move to the floor of the due passage.
And Senator Mendez.
Amended.
Move Bill 620 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. So you made me go to your committee at 7 o'clock this morning, so what do you expect? And Senator R. Beyer is still the carrier. At 2251, open work session at 2251 to be referred to Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is just a bill that was supposed to go there in the first place.
So moved.
Senator Menace moves House Bill 2251 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Further discussion, objection, it's ordered. Did I do that one right?
That was perfect.
Okay. 2001 is delayed to 2010, delayed. Representative Patridge, what purpose do you arrive?
2515, Chair. A minute of testimony.
All right, open.
Not go away.
Open work session, House Bill 2513.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, State Representative Rob Patridge, House District 50, Medford. I'm here on House Bill 2513. As many of you may be aware, we looked at the criminal fines and assessments account. During the interim, it produced between $14 and $20 million new dollars in revenue because of the fact that municipal courts, predominantly JP courts, were waiving those fees. Consequently, that money wasn't going to the various programs, including domestic violence, police training, and the state general fund. Consequently, in conducting the audit that we recommended the Secretary of State do, that resulted in the fact that this money would be collected. Nobody in the state has a registry of all the state courts or all the municipal courts and JP courts. Consequently, we want to have those registered somewhere so we can account for them. The Municipal Court Association does not oppose this. The League of Oregon Cities, my understanding, does not oppose this. And I don't know where the JPs stand on the issue, but we had no testimony against it. So I'd ask you to put this out as a housekeeping bill. I think it's important that we know where our courts are in the state. That would be something nice that we would know in a centralized place. I know the League...
I don't like the answer.
I know the League of Oregon Cities had some other technical amendment that they wanted to add on to this bill. I'm not opposed to their technical amendment. I just was here on the main bill.
Hang on just a second. Christy?
Here comes.
And this is just the League thing.
Just hang on a minute.
Thank you, Chair Harper. Christy Munson with the League of Oregon Cities. Last session, a bill was passed that had a minor snafu in it. It allowed all courts, all jurors appearing in all courts to waive...
Excuse me a minute. I just have an amendment that still has the ink wet on it. And this is your amendment?
It still has the...
Ink wet.
Ink wet.
Oh.
This is your amendment?
That is our amendment.
Do I know about this amendment?
We have discussed it with Representative Patridge. We have not discussed it with you, Chair Harper.
So I don't know about it?
No.
Why do you want me to work on an amendment that I know nothing about in the middle of the last waning days of the session? Mm-hmm. How are you trying to stiff me?
No, Chair Harper. We just found out about it. The city attorneys called me this week, and there was a mistake in legislation that's to go into effect in July. And this is just fixing that mistake so that it does not go into effect in July. what it does is right now all courts are able, besides municipal courts, are able to waive the $10 juror fee. And because of the way it was written in the old language, municipal courts are not allowed to waive it. So this just allows municipal courts to waive that fee.
Okay.
That's okay. Did you get a copy of that?
Mm-hmm.
That's
fine.
We got them. Bless you.
Thank you.
Are you sure I'm not going to live to regret this?
I'm sure, Senator Harper.
I will come burn your house down.
Sounds like a man with some experience. All right.
And I burned them down before. Okay, I've got the amendments. Representative Patridge was okay. He skipped, and that, you sure? Okay.
Mr. Chair, I'd move the Dash A3 amendment.
All right, Senator Brown moves the Dash A3 to House Bill 2513. Further discussion, objection, hearing none. So ordered.
I move the bill as amended to set forth the due pass recommendation.
And Senator Brown moves the House Bill 2513 as amended for the due pass recommendation. Discussion, objection, hearing none. So ordered. I guess you have it.
Oh, great.
Thank you.
Does that mean you're going to come burn my house down, too?
If I live to regret it, yes. Representative Nelson, what are you here for? 38.
Chair Harper, 3890.
38. And Representative Morissette. All right, we will open work session on House Bill 3890. Please continue.
Okay.
Chair Harper and members of the committee on Senate Rules and Redistricting Committee, it's an honor to have this opportunity to appear before you today in testimony for House Bill 3890. I am State Representative Donna Nelson of District 29 from McMinnville, located in Yamhill County. On behalf of the citizens of Oregon, thank you for your time and consideration of this very important issue. House Bill 3890 establishes the format and process for evaluating the efficiency, effectiveness, economic factors, employee productivity, and excellence of select agencies of our state government on behalf of our citizenry with earnestness of purpose, what I call the 6E philosophy. As an advocate for our taxpayers, our wage earners, our children, our seniors, our veterans, our disabled and disadvantaged, and our families, I feel responsible and accountable for their well-being. That's why management with measurement is essential as we participate as a team with our state agencies to secure the performance of critical services, which the citizens have deemed essential for their present and future. As you have had the tremendously challenging job of studying a vast variety of bills in your positions, you're cognizant of the difficulty of being able to focus on the full detail of the requirements and performance of our many commissions, agencies, and departments within our state government. It's my strong belief that with a task force concentrating on differently sized organizations incrementally, we can best delineate the cost-effective excellence of the fulfillment of their missions. Zero-based budgeting is an excellent complement to traditional budgeting, current service level budgeting, which looks at what we spent in the last budget cycle and is incremental but has the disadvantage of the base not being scrutinized, but the advantage of stability. Our outstanding Ways and Means Committee and Revenue Committee understand the fiscal complications of our system. When we combine our traditional system with performance-based budgeting, as Representative Morissette will represent to you, identifying goals to be achieved and consequences of goals not achieved, we become more efficient. Adding zero-based budgeting requires each agency or organization to justify its existence and all spending like starting anew at ground zero. This mixture brings the best picture of fiscal accountability. And according to the National Conference of State Legislatures, most states are moving toward this mixture. key to zero-based budgeting is identifying and evaluating alternatives for each activity, stressing that as each agency prepares its budget, it considers alternative methods for performing the activity or providing a service and alternative levels of effort. As the agency determines, quote, best way performance, unquote, it considers various levels of efforts and prepares a decision package for each level. This step thus leads to ranking decision packages, which will ultimately constitute the budget request for the agency. It is at this ranking process that some packages ranked at the lower levels may be disapproved. We are all taxed with a responsibility to be sure that our purpose in a bureaucracy is not simply to grow that bureaucracy. I'm thankful for you professional men and women in our state government who genuinely care about our citizens and giving back to them the greatest possible return on their investment through dedication and cost-effective excellence. I'm thankful for you who have committed your lives to public service, and I will appreciate your support of House Bill 3890 in the best interest of what matters most, the well-being of our people. And now I'd like to ask Representative Morissette to present the performance-based budgeting part of this bill, which became an amendment.
Okay. Committee, we need to get this to Ways and Means, but I think it's a really good idea. I'd like to ship it out here with a due pass. So
great.
Anything to add, Representative Morissette?
No, that's fine. Thank you.
Yeah, Senator Beyer and
Representatives, I'm curious about the discussions you might have had with DAS. I believe it was the 1975 legislature adopted zero-based budget, modified zero-based budgeting for the state of Oregon, and we've been doing that since then. How would this differ from the classical modified zero-based budgeting?
Well, may I respond to that? Representative Bill Morissette, District 42. Last year when we presented this bill, we met with John Yonkers and Teresa McKeown and John Latimer and had a long discussion as to whether or not performance-based budgeting was really happening. And they felt that it was not really happening, that they were not there yet. We used Florida as a model, and Teresa said that she was intimately familiar with what they were doing and thought that they were on the right track. And so they are supportive, and we discussed this with, of course, John Yonkers is gone, but with Teresa McKeown and John Latimer again this time, and they are supportive of finding a more exact way of setting the goals and doing the measurements. Now, what this bill would do is, it's a pilot project with three agencies, and they would do both the zero-based and performance-based, and try it out for a couple of sessions and then hopefully expand it. But they acknowledge that they weren't there yet and that they would like to go there and do a better job in refining.
The difference between the two kinds of...
Yes, yes.
Senator Brown.
Talking about any interplay you see between this going to zero-based budgeting and our benchmark system?
Well, we also talked with Jeff Trident last time, not this session, but about benchmarks, and many states are envious of our benchmarks, but the benchmarks don't really do what needs to be done in terms of the budgeting, but they would enhance and complement and fit in nicely with our benchmarks. But Jeff Trident is also supportive of taking this next step as an enhancement to the benchmarks.
Yeah, I said I think something that we ought to, we all want to improve our product, and I think we need to take a look at it. So, for the discussion committee, okay, I'll take a motion to re-refer this.
Mr. Chair, I'd refer this to Committee on Ways and Means.
I don't know. We want to send it down with a due pass recommendation.
Due pass recommendation.
Recommendation.
That's okay. What I meant.
Yeah. Senator Brown moves House Bill 3890. They refer to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion, objection, hearing none.
Thank you so much,
thank you.
Chair Harper and committee.
No. Open work session, House Bill 2213. Phil, Keith.
Thank you.
We have some dash sevens.
Yes. Chair Harper, members of the committee.
We'll save the world.
For the record, Philip Schradl, special counsel to the Attorney General. Senator Harper, I think I would probably characterize these more as baby steps, but I think they are necessary and very critical baby steps. There are four changes made in House Bill 2213 with the dash seven amendments. And I'll very, very briefly walk you through those. The first two changes are really clarifications that are added just to bring certainty to the current process. The current statute talks about filing the Secretary of State, bringing things over immediately, and that has caused some consternation. We want to change that to on the next business day. The second one is also a very minimal clarification about notice shall be given, and we think it should read notice must be filed in the Secretary of State's office. The third piece is a little bit more substantive, and that is to add five business days for our office to respond to comments that get filed on ballot titles and to file our certified ballot title. That was unopposed over on the House side, and it only adds five business days, and it's critical for our office's operations to be able to, with complex and substantial matters, to be able to have that additional time. The biggest piece of this is in the dash seven amendments, which adds in a critical component that fills what could be a very gaping hole in the ballot title process. Currently pending before Mr. Garza's court is a case called Flanagan versus Myers. And in that case, the court's faced with the constitutional question of whether the court can rewrite ballot titles that our office has drafted. There's a very real likelihood that the court will conclude that it cannot, as a constitutional matter, rewrite ballot titles. And the current statutes are open-ended. They are silent on that point about what happens as a process matter after that. And the dash seven amendments fill that hole in the statutory process and allow the court to refer that matter back to our office for modification of the ballot title in light of the court's conclusion that our first attempt did not comply with the statutes. I think that all of these matters would be not really contentious or problematic for any of the participants in the ballot title process. And they are four very helpful pieces that do not change the process substantially, but that would aid us to draft better ballot titles and to avoid a real constitutional problem if the Supreme Court decides Flanagan, as we think it may well do so. Strongly encourage the committee's support of this and ask that you pass it out with a due pass recommendation. Be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Minnis.
Is there a fiscal?
Chair Harper, Senator Minnis, no, there should not be.
Even though the work's coming back to you to rewrite it, there's no fiscal.
Chair Harper, Senator Minnis, I don't think that the impact on our office would be sufficient enough to cause any kind of a fiscal impact that the committee would need to consider.
That workload.
No, we will, Chair Harper, Senator Minnis, we will do that workload, but it should not add significantly. It would not add any attorney positions or anything.
We have 10 lawyers doing ballot titles as it is. So.
That's why I think we ought to just repeal them.
Yes. Next session. I'm trying to get home.
What's related?
Other discussion.
Keith. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Keith Garza. I'm the senior appellate staff attorney to the Oregon Supreme Court. The court has not taken a position either on House Bill 2213 or the dash 7 amendments. I did, however, want to address briefly in one respect that part of the dash 7 amendments that would institute the referral process from the Supreme Court to the Attorney General for those ballot titles that the court determines do not substantially comply. I think from a mechanical standpoint, that referral process, as it's set out in the dash 7 amendments, would work. I think it is procedurally sound and would prove workable both from the standpoint of the court and from the litigants. I guess as a prudential matter, in light of the questions that have been raised in the Flanagan proceeding, I think that it is a good idea for the legislature to consider some kind of a contingent fix depending on the outcome of that case. So unless anybody has any questions, thank you for considering my testimony.
I do have one question.
Senator Minnis.
So the court finds that the ballot title is deficient in some way. Do they share with you what deficiency they see?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Minnis. Typically, the proceeding would come, as it happens now, the deficiencies are set out in the court's opinion. I suppose there is a question latent within this referral scheme. If the court were to have a valid title that it finds does not substantially comply, it would need to communicate that fact to the parties and to the Attorney General in the referral process. I expect that that would also occur in the context of an opinion. How elaborate or not, I don't know.
But I guess it's possible that you would get a ruling that doesn't elaborate on what they feel the deficiency would be.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Minnis, I suppose that's a possibility.
I mean, the court seems to be reluctant to give a lot of direction in rulings for whatever reason. So we're creating a system where the court's going to say this does not substantially comply, but there's no direction here to the court to request or even request that they articulate what they feel the defects might be and how it can be remedied.
Chairman, Senator Minnis, I understand your question. I think there would be a concern perhaps if the court had not addressed whether it is constitutional for it to modify ballot titles or to revisit that question, and then have to send a non-compliant ballot title back to the Attorney General's office, at what point would the opinion be simply directing the Attorney General to do drafting on the court's behalf? On the other hand, if there's going to be a back and forth, probably not a whole lot of good will come if the court says nothing at all. So if I had to offer a guess, I suspect it would be something in the middle.
Okay.
Thank you.
Further questions? Further discussion? Anybody else want to talk about this thing? Okay, I've got some dash sevens.
Mr. Chair, I'd move the dash A7s.
Senator Brown moves the dash sevens to House Bill 2213. Discussion, objection, ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move the bill as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Brown moves House Bill 2213 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion, objection, hearing none, so ordered. All right.
Carrier.
I'll do it. Senator Minnis, don't you want to do this one?
I don't like ballot titles. I think we should make it look.
All right. What if somebody asked me a question, though? I'm in deep trouble.
Okay.
Hearing the closed work session. Representative Merkley, 3917, is that what you're here for?
Yes,
Representative Nolan?
What? She's here for 2575.
For 2575,
but I don't need to speak unless you want to. Okay, Representative Merkley, why don't we just, you got about 10 minutes?
Yes, I do.
Okay, 2575. Open work session 2575. Come up and talk to us. We haven't heard from you all session.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much for hearing this bill. Mary Nolan, State Representative from House District 11, Southwest Portland. This bill is a bill that helps the Secretary of State provide accurate and timely information about managing the financial reports for campaign contributions. Someone from the Secretary of State's office can speak to those details much more effectively than I can. My interest in the bill evolves from a section of it that assures parity between the reports that we as candidates provide and the reports that are provided by committees supporting or opposing ballot measures. The purpose of that section is to put those reports on parity, same number, almost exactly the same timing, to minimize the impact on the Secretary of State and to provide information to the public. Thank you for your attention.
Was this your idea? This is a good idea.
It was my idea then. Thank you, sir.
All right. Thank you. Steve Lanning, Fred Neal. We'll see if this is a good idea.
Good
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Fred Neal, campaign finance manager for the Secretary of State's Elections Division. What 2575A engrossed does is two things. First, it rolls back the filing deadlines for candidates and political committees for all elections in this state for the second, first pre and second pre report back 7 days, so that the second pre-election report comes out a little more simultaneously with the mailing of the ballots for elections, so that information about contributions and expenditures is available to the media and the public at about the same time they're getting their ballots and deciding how to vote. In order to do that, that affects this the large contribution requirement of the supplement to the second pre, where contributions of over $500 have to be reported. To accommodate that and to provide or require information on expenditures exceeding $1,000 in that now longer period, we've added a first supplement to the second pre and a second supplement to the second pre. The second thing that this bill does, as Representative Nolan said, is it does provide for additional reports from chief petitioner committees. So for a total of four, if they come out of the chute well-funded and highly active. The handout that you've gotten from us will show you how those reporting periods match up with the current reporting periods. The first one for chief petitioners would be at the same deadline as the September supplemental for all of you if you have balances remaining in your campaign funds. And that's only if those chief petitioner committees have gone over $2,000 in activity by that time. If they have not, they don't need to file, but all chief petitioner committees who, as of January 31st, have gone over $2,000 in activity, they need to file a second report or their first report. Finally, they would all chief petitioner committees file a report prior to about at the same time as you as candidates would be filing second pre-election reports, so that everyone knows what money's being raised and spent by all chief petitioner committees prior to the filing deadline of signatures for verification. Of course, as you realize, the only report now required of chief petitioners is that one that's required 15 days after the deadline.
Do you want this bill?
Yep. Just wanted to get that on.
Steve, do you want this bill?
Never mind.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Senator Courtney.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2575A and goes to Senate floor to do pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves House Bill 2575A and goes to the floor to do pass recommendation. Further discussion? Objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
I'll carry this one, Mr. Chair.
Who needs to suck up the Secretary of State? Is that Senator Brown? Is that,
I don't, but I'm happy to carry.
All right.
You know who I think needs to suck up the Secretary of State?
I think I'll carry this bill. Probably want to go down and have lots of conversations.
I can care. I'll care. Care.
All right, close work session.
Do you have a favorite chocolate you can bring?
Favorite chocolate? I'm looking for whiskey. I use whiskey as my. Representative Berger, 3413. Award. Can you give us about 5 minutes? We'll be there directly. All right. Open work session 2578. Fred.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Fred Neal, campaign finance manager for the Secretary of State's Elections Division. This bill comes to you in order to avoid the potential of the Secretary of State being in what is an untenable position for him of enforcing the false statements issued by candidates or committees prior to an election. Back when Clay Myers was Secretary of State, it was a criminal offense. Of course, criminal offenses take an extended period of time to investigate and prosecute, and so any resolution of an alleged false statement by an opponent in a campaign would not be resolved until well after the election. At Mr. Meyer's request, the legislature made this a civil cause of action between the parties involved, and that is how we have interpreted the statutes ever since. But there is the potential of a new, broader interpretation of the undue influence statute, portions of which are Class C felonies that, with the use of fraud in that statute...
Sir, do you want this bill?
Yes, sir.
All right, Senator Courtney.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2578 to the Senate floor to pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves House Bill 2578, not A, engrossed, for the due pass recommendation. Discussion, objection. Hearing none, so ordered. Yeah, I'll let somebody else suck up to the Secretary of State. Senator Atkinson, you need one too. So. All right, closed work session. 17, right? Open work session 3917. Representative Merkley, now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Representative Jeff Merkley. There are two amendments, I believe, on your desk, the A6 and the A7. I believe Mr. DiLorenzo is here to speak to the A6 amendment. I'm here to speak to the A7 and to say it's a very good amendment worked out by the parties, and I think it makes the bill ready to go forward. Thank you.
Thank you. You all agree? Let's see. Cheryl, Don, and... John DiLorenzo.
Senator Harper, members of the committee, good morning. I'll be very brief. This bill is the result of work by the Attorney General's Manufactured Housing Task Force. It has the support of the Department of Justice, the industry, and of consumer groups representing manufactured housing owners. 3917. We ask you to look at the Dash 7 amendments. It basically is a rewrite of the original A. Engrossed bill. The problem that it addresses are twofold. One, some dealers, when arranging financing for the purchase of a manufactured home, have told purchasers that they have to buy credit life, health, or disability insurance or an extended warranty contract as a condition of financing when that's not the case. Second, in order to make a sale, some salesmen or salespeople have misrepresented a purchaser's employment history or have made up the amount or existence of a down payment in order to qualify the purchaser for financing that they wouldn't otherwise be eligible for. This bill targets those two practices and makes them unlawful. These result in consumers purchasing insurance that they don't need, extended service contracts that duplicate the manufacturer's original warranty, and they don't add any additional value, but what they do is they increase the amount that the consumer is financing while not increasing the value of what they're getting in return. House Bill 3917, the A7s, address both of those problems, makes them an unlawful trade practices act. They're subject to private action by a consumer or action by the Attorney General's office. So if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Okay. Don?
I'll even be briefer. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Don Miner here on behalf of Oregon Manufactured Housing Association to speak in support of the A7 amendments. The practices declared there being declared unlawful damage not only consumers but industry, and we think the bill serves a good purpose and should go forward as amended.
John.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. John DiLorenzo appearing on behalf of my client GE Capital Corporation. We're here to advocate the Dash 6 amendments. GE Capital does not take a position on the bill itself and is only here to talk about the Dash 6s. The Dash 6s address a problem which has developed and for which we have found a solution that has been acceptable by all parties concerned. It relates to Oregon's collection agency licensing law. The collection agency licensing law is different from the Debt Collection Practices Act. It is not a consumer protection law. It concerns the relationship between creditors and the debt collectors. My client uses a number of its subsidiaries to collect its own debts, and so none of our subsidiaries can possibly be a competitive threat to any other debt collection agencies, because all we do is collect our own debts and we do nothing else besides that, and debt collection is sort of ancillary to our main business. Unlike many other licensing statutes, DCBS does not have the ability to exempt from coverage of the licensing law persons who they believe by rule or order pose no threat to the public safety, welfare, et cetera, et cetera. And so we are proposing on page 4 of the A6 amendments to just add a new section that allows the director to exempt from that particular licensing statute any person who the director by order or rule believes does not pose any threat to the public health, safety, or welfare, and it does not require registration. The director of DCBS supports the amendment, would like to have the authority. My client certainly does. Mr. Marquis from the Oregon Collectors Association has been very helpful, and I understand his organization supports the amendment. Mr. Kruger from the department, and I understand that the Department of Justice has reviewed the amendment and has no objection to the amendment.
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay, everybody's happy with the sixes and sevens, and I'm not going to regret it if I pass them out.
No one's house.
Which I need your home addresses.
Never mind.
Pat, you're signed up okay with everything here? That's what you say? We're all right. You guys got together. So this yellow sheet says kill this bill without amendments. You made the amendments. Okay.
Mr. Chair. Any work session?
Yes, Senator Courtney.
I move the dash six amendments, A6 amendments to House Bill 3917.
Senator Courtney moves the A6 is 3917. Further discussion? Objection? Hearing none. Ordered.
Chair, I move the dash A7 amendments to House Bill 3917.
Senator Courtney moves the dash 7 A7 amendments to 3917. Discussion? Objection? Ordered.
Mr. Chairman, of House Bill 3917 is amended to Senate floor to do pass recommendation.
And Senator Courtney moves House Bill 3917 as amended to the floor to do pass recommendation. Discussion, objection, so ordered. May I want this in Senator Baez?
Certainly.
Okay. All right, close work session.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you very much.
Raise your hands if you're here for 3413. Several. Representative Berger, let's go to that one. Open public hearing, House Bill 3413.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Joanne Berger from House District 47. I'm here to urge your support of House Bill 3413, which revises the statutory requirement for the State Highway Modernization Program to allow federal money, as well as state highway funds, to be used to meet the statutory requirement. House Bill 3413 will not lessen the amount of funds spent on highway modernization, but it will help ODOT better maximize the use of federal and state funds, benefiting the transportation system as a whole on both the state and local levels, which is exactly what we want ODOT to do. Currently, the Oregon Department of Transportation is required to use the state funds to meet modernization requirements. The majority of those funds are being spent on projects that would already be federalized, meaning that state dollars are being spent on projects that are built to federal standards. We wouldn't do this in our own business. It is more efficient for ODOT to use federal dollars on federalized projects and gain efficiencies by using state dollars where their benefits can be maximized. As you're well aware, Oregon's transportation infrastructure is aging, and we need to maintain the system. We've not kept up with its needs. So with limited resources, Oregon must make the most efficient use of transportation dollars. The House of Representatives unanimously agreed this is a good bill. I urge that you pass it to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Berger. Questions? Comments? Thank you. And I understand the counties and the cities are all right. Close the public hearing. Open the work session. One more.
Chair, move House Bill 3413.
Let's go.
Got a motion, sir.
Senator Byer moves House Bill 3413, A, engrossed, to the Senate floor, the due pass recommendation. Any objections? None. Got it.
Okay.
Senator Brown.
What's next?
2335. Okay, open work session, House Bill 2335. Ingrid and...
For the record, my name is Brad Swank. I'm with the State Court Administrator's Office. 2335 is the Oregon Judicial Department's housekeeping bill. It's a bill in which we collect a number of different suggestions made by judges and employees and other people related to making the Judicial Department more responsive, more efficient, and operate better. There are nine things that the nine different technical adjustments that the bill does. And I know Ingrid is here on just one of them, so I'll cover the others quickly so you'll know what they are, and then we can discuss the difference that we have on the one. The first thing that the bill does is split the 18th Judicial District, which is Tillamook and Clatsop counties, into two separate judicial districts. They're currently one judicial district. They've been operating for a number of years as separate judicial districts with two judges in each district with separate trial court administrators. This wouldn't move the judges. It wouldn't change anything they're doing. It would just officially recognize what they're doing de facto now. The second change would be to allow the Court Publications Fund, which is a fund that we have, to provide for electronic access to court publications. Currently, it's silent about that. We want to make sure we can use the money for that purpose. The third thing that it does is rename the Supreme Court Law Library to be the State of Oregon Law Library, because that's the function that it serves. It's not just the Supreme Court. Everybody gets to use it, and they wanted the name changed to reflect its actual purpose. The fourth thing that it does, there's a current requirement that attorneys submit information about settlements that they reach. It was a law that was passed in the 80s in response to tort reform. The attorneys aren't submitting it, so we can't collect it. There's no enforcement mechanism. It's gone out of, it's something we don't enter the data for. Attorneys have asked that we repeal it. Court clerks have asked that we repeal it, so it's we've put the repeal in there. The fifth thing that it does is to remove a prohibition about judges being personal representatives in family-related matters. A couple of years ago, the legislature removed a prohibition about judges being guardians for family members in appropriate situations. There's a current statutory prohibition about judges being personal representatives for estates of their family members. This removes that prohibition. The Oregon Code of Judicial Conduct still applies and would limit it to so that they were only personal representatives for family estate kinds of things. Make life easier for judges and those stressful times less problematic. The sixth thing that it does is add a statutory exception to the notice requirements for the change of name change for a minor to allow people who are getting their name changed to use a less expensive notice procedure. The seventh thing it does, and this is something of a problem, there's a bill that was passed last session to allow, on the third and subsequent days, to allow jurors to get minimum wage. Well, and implementing that, we've discovered that it would be less expensive for us to just pay them in half-day increments rather than having to establish a whole system where we keep hours for jurors all over the state. So what it does is allow them to be paid in half-day increments rather than us having to keep hours. The eighth one is the one where Ingrid and we disagree. And so I'll go on to the ninth one. The ninth one changes an obsolete, there's a reference in statute to a repealed provision of law, so we substituted it with the appropriate provision of law. And that's one that was brought to us by Legislative Counsel's Office. Now I'll mention, go to the eighth change that does, and these are sections 14 through 17. These result, for a number of years, the Judicial Department has not released personal information from master and term jury lists, and we didn't do that pursuant to an Attorney General opinion that said that the information was confidential and couldn't be released. In December of 2000, the Supreme Court
I issued a decision that said that defense counsel and attorneys in cases may have a right to get this information to challenge the jury selection process. One of the things that the Supreme Court decision said was that there was no statutory procedure for them to get this confidential information. And so we introduced these sections to establish a statutory procedure for attorneys to get this confidential information when they wanted to raise a jury challenge. In the House, when this was brought to us a few weeks before the bill was to be heard, we asked for the amendments. We made sure before the bill was scheduled that both the defense attorneys and the prosecuting attorneys had copies of the amendments so they could look at them before the bill was scheduled and raised issues. And they testified at the first hearing about their opposition to some of the provisions that we had done, a specific provision that I'll mention in a second. And we asked at that time, and it was in our original testimony for the first hearing of the bill, that we have a couple of weeks to work with them to see if we could either reach compromise on the bill, some kind of consensus to proceed with the bill, or we could bring to the committee the policy issues that were involved in this particular issue that they were concerned about. We worked for about 2 weeks, which is what the committee gave us, talked back and forth, and we could not reach consensus. We made clear when we presented the bill at the hearing that we were not in consensus, that they disagreed with us. And let me go to the point of disagreement. If you look at the bill, essentially as the amendments are drafted for the procedure, it establishes a judge as a gatekeeper. We modeled the procedure so that it doesn't change the current procedure for civil cases. In civil cases, you submit an affidavit, and this is RCP 57A4, I think, and then it says you can use certain information. It doesn't say how you get that information, but it says you can use it to support the motion, not that you have to submit it with the affidavit. We modeled the criminal procedure after that, so we didn't have to submit or change the civil procedure, and basically the procedure that we submit is that we presented was that somebody has to submit an affidavit stating facts that, if true, would constitute grounds for requesting the information. This allows the judge to be the gatekeeper, so if they come up with some fact-based reason for saying we want this information, they can get it. We don't care. It's not hard to provide. Our fear is that if the judges are not allowed to be the gatekeeper, that in every criminal case, attorneys will feel compelled to seek this information because they'll feel like there would be ineffective assistance of counsel if they don't. So the disagreement that we have is whether or not the judge gets to be a gatekeeper at the front end of when they request the information. And if you look at the bill, that is on page 8 of the bill. The last time I talked to Ingrid, this was the only point of disagreement that we had. And it was on page 8 of the bill, lines 20 and 21. And we made the committee on the House side very aware of that disagreement, and we continue to believe that the judge needs to serve some kind of gatekeeping function.
Mr. Chair, I assume you don't have access to the records until the judge releases them, correct?
Chair Harper, Senator Brown, the records that they're seeking are lists of names and addresses. Most of the information and associates them with a particular jury pool.
Okay. I'm going to take you in a little different direction.
Yeah.
If you don't have access to the records, how do you know whether those records are actually in support of your motion or not?
Chair Harper, Senator Brown, we would believe that there would be some. What we do, if I can explain the process briefly, is we take the lists from the Motor Vehicles Division supplies us with a list of licensed drivers, and the Secretary of State's office supplies us with a list of registered voters, and we merge those lists and we eliminate duplicates, and from that we randomly, and what we keep are names, addresses, telephone numbers, how to collect them. We don't keep cognizable, individually identified. We don't know race, we don't know sex, we don't know all of those things. We don't keep. And then we select from that randomly. The courts tell us we're going to need for this term so many jurors, so we select randomly from that list for that county the number that they need and send that to them electronically. So what they're getting is a list of names and addresses that came from DMV or from the voters. And
but how do you know that it's in support of what you're doing until you actually see the list? And that's really the only language of contention, correct? Because you both have relevant evidence. So the issue is whether it's in support of or not.
Chair Harper, Senator Brown, we suspect that you would suspect something was wrong with the jury system because you saw something was happening. You weren't getting an appropriate selection of minorities. You weren't doing something like that. Our point is that any of those facts that you present in an affidavit where you've actually seen something wrong with the jury system that leads you to believe there's a problem with the selection should be appropriate to submit to a judge in an affidavit and say we need to see the records to see that, as opposed to the situation which we believe they're proposing, which says we don't know if anything's wrong with the jury system, but let us spend the time to go check, without the judge acting as a gatekeeper at the front to find some fact that there is some issue that has led you to believe that there may be a problem with the system, that every defense attorney in every case would feel compelled to raise the argument. And we've seen it. We've gotten a number of challenges in the last year and a half. There are, 30 cases or so where in different counties where things have been filed, and they're starting to go down to the misdemeanor level where they're filing for this information. Most of those are currently tied up in the Supreme Court.
Well, there have been legal issues in those cases.
Well, and we've released files. We have an attorney who's gotten the files under a procedure very similar to what we propose, and she got it in February, March, and in talking to her when this was on the House side, she still wasn't sure what she was going to do with the lists because she wasn't sure what she established for her. And I hear that last Monday she filed a motion for additional information that's not confidential. They want to send something out to jurors or call jurors and contact them, and we don't, you know, it's not the list itself that answered the question for her. So we think that the judge should have some gatekeeping function at the beginning, a small hurdle. We don't think it's a substantial barrier that it creates, so that this doesn't become a frivolous thing and just generate more costs in indigent defense. And that's our basic disagreement, as I understand it. I'm sure Ingrid can clarify it for you.
We are going to get clarified here.
I hope so. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Senator Brown has hit upon the only issue that we have with this bill, and some of the provisions of this bill appear in Senate Bill 70 as well. The point is that we cannot show that these records support our motion unless we see them. The current standard for civil litigants is that they can produce these lists in support of their motion for a hearing. So we're simply asking that that same standard be applied in criminal cases, that among the things that we have to have access to before we can file a motion challenging a jury panel is, you know, what the lists are and whether they're representative. And the amendments that I have offered, the A3 amendments, preserve all of the limitations on the use of that information that we can make that are in the bill. The only thing it changes is that initial showing. So I want to bring to your attention a case that arose in Connecticut. This is United States versus Osorio. It's a federal case at 81 Federal Sup 966, 1992 case. In that case, the defense obtained these jury lists and after examining them realized that due to a computer error on the part of the courts, they had eliminated three entire communities from the list, not intentionally, but accidentally. It turned out that those were all the African-American communities in the area. So this jury panel had a very small representation of African-Americans due to this oversight, which was caused by a computer. You would never have known that. Yes, you could watch 10 or 15 jury trials and say, there's something wrong here, our panel is short of African-Americans, but that can be due to lots of other causes, and you can't show in advance that there may have been a computer error here until you have actually seen those records. And let me explain what the point is of getting those. The in 1985, when the legislature passed this law about jury source lists, basically the idea was that the Supreme Court would include multiple lists, the voters lists and motor vehicle division lists, but any additional lists that the Supreme Court felt were necessary in order to have a panel that sort of reflected the community in which it sat. And that's to fulfill the obligation of ORS 10030, which says that we can't discriminate in our jury panels based on race, national origin, gender, age, religious belief, income, occupation, or any other cognizable factor. We can't get there unless we know who these jurors are. Now, in the case that Mr. Swank is talking about, the attorney did obtain, after litigation, access to those lists. Her use of that is very restricted. She's only allowed to use that for a survey purpose. She has arranged with Portland State University to survey this list of jurors to see, and all they're allowed to answer is questions based on the list of cognizable factors. This has not been done in many years, and in a sense, it's the only way we know or can know if these lists are an adequate number of lists and reach an adequate number of people and are properly being selected so that we're getting a cross-section of our community. Indeed, I do think it is an obligation of the defense bar to make sure periodically that that's happening. Now, will we do that in every case? Well, that would be ridiculous. First of all, in Clatsop County, where this matter is pending, they select that 5,000 jury member list for a period of 1 year. So certainly you're not going to do it more than once in a year. And it's my belief that most counties are sort of on the same basis. And if you found huge discrepancies there, then indeed you might want to pursue it in other counties based on those same issues. But we have no interest in doing this in every case. Civil litigants certainly have not abused their authority, and there's no limitation on their ability to do it in every case. When this legislation passed in 1985, Bill Linden was the current state court administrator at the time, and his testimony on House Bill 2985, which became ORS 10215, was that the master list has to be available for examination. For example, if someone wanted to scientifically test representativeness of the jury pool, they would have to make that available to them. So at the time the legislature passed this legislation, it was well understood that access had to be given so that we could test the reliability of this data.
Chair Harper, Senator Brown, I'd like to make a couple of corrections if I can. First of all, to note that we were following, notwithstanding Bill Linden's testimony, we've been following since 1987 an attorney general's opinion telling us when we could release the lists and we couldn't. Secondly, we do not contest that these lists should be available. The Supreme Court said so in the Brown Hill case. We believe they should be available. We believe there should be protections so jurors' personal information doesn't appear on the Internet as DMV's list did a couple of years ago. That's the issue in this. What we're trying to do is establish a procedure, and notwithstanding what Ms. Winston said, if you look at ORCP 57, it talks about getting juror lists. It says that you submit an affidavit, and then it says you can use certain information in support of your motion. What it is silent about is the procedure by which you get that information. And that's something the Supreme Court noted, that the statutes were silent about the procedure. We do believe, and when we talked with the district attorneys on the other side, because this was the issue that we debated on the other side, the district attorneys were concerned that this not be an open gate, that where the issue of jury selection of the larger pool came up in every case, and they weren't sure that we had established a big enough bar. Well, we're reasonably certain that, one, we think people should get these this information in appropriate cases. They should be able to make the inquiries. If these lists help, that's fine. But we also think that the judge should serve some gatekeeping function to stop the frivolous instances where it would spread to every case. And that's the area that in the House we discussed and we were unable to come to an agreement on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I'm on a jury call right now. And it's the second time in 3 years I went in and I made it all the way to the finals. And what you're telling me is these attorneys had certain stuff on me or could have certain stuff on me if this bill passes. I mean, I'm still not able, in response to Senator Brown's question, I think it was her question, or at least it's now my question, I don't know what information is, they got my name somehow, obviously, and I don't know how much information went along with my name, number one. I can't tell, Brad, from what you're talking about, what kind of information.
They have access to labs, don't they?
Do they? Is that what it is? I don't know. Is that what it is, a background
check?
I can't tell, Brad.
Chair Harper, Senator Courtner, currently what we get for jurors, we get name, right. We get address, right. Things that we can send out to
everyday stuff.
So everyday stuff, except it's associated with the juror, and some people try and keep that confidential. There are limitations that you've placed on access to DMV records, for instance. Right. And what this bill, and we don't give that out to people currently, and we haven't for 12 years. Right. And this bill would preserve that. But it would allow, the way it's drafted, would allow defense attorneys to get that information about your address and name.
Right. But what Bill Linden did was the jury list that we're out is just names, nothing but names.
Addresses.
Nothing else.
Addresses.
You just said that doesn't go out.
It doesn't go out. No, and the names don't go out.
It does or doesn't go out?
We create a term jury list for the court, which we send to the court, which has names and addresses and things that allow us to get a hold of the person.
Okay.
And that information does not go to attorneys.
If that's all that we're talking about, that's all that we're talking about here, nothing
mm-hmm.
more,
mm-hmm.
how can I make an argument that... I mean, I don't know how you make a why relevancy. How can I even make an argument of relevancy unless I have the list?
Mr. Chair, Senator Courtney, the argument is not relevancy. The argument is in support of.
Mm-hmm.
Both.
Well, yeah, but the jury records sought are likely to produce relevant evidence in support of the motion.
In support of are the key words.
Because
they both say both. Both approaches would say that the evidence is relevant. It has to be relevant.
The motion is to get the jury records, right?
Right.
So if I'm going to make that motion, I don't know how or justify that motion. I just say, well, I need their home addresses, right? I need their home addresses because, I want to know if they represent the whole community.
Well,
that's it. I'd make that motion. I mean, if you're supposed to be a jury of your peers, I want to know their records because is the age on there? Was my age on there?
I don't recollect whether the
age. Well, but would it be?
Date of birth, I thought.
Well, my age is on there. Where I live in the community is on there. Is my race on there?
No.
I don't know. I got a driving record is on there, right? Mm-hmm. So at least I got a license. They know that.
No, we don't keep the license number.
I don't know how. I would make the motion, and I don't, I just say I want the records because the only way I can know, to the extent that all of a sudden is an issue for me, I don't know why. This is a case where I want to make sure there's a jury of his or her peers, and I want to make sure it's community-wide, not just in West Salem, because West Salem doesn't like me because I'm from North Salem. There's a bit of a community thing going on here that you don't know about, Brad. But, so the fact is, I want to make sure that I got some West Salem, I want South Salem, I want North Salem, I want the whole community. I don't know. I don't understand why it's such a big deal here.
Well, Chair Harper, Senator Courtney, if I can, when we talk to jurors, one of the biggest fears that jurors express, particularly in criminal cases, is that the criminal or one of his buddies is going to find out that they're on a jury and what their address is, so they can go after him. And To the extent that these records are available, the broader these records are available publicly, the more likely that is to happen, because they're associating a name of a person with a jury pool and their address and their location with the jury that they're on.
These records available, either one of the attorneys is then going to write down all that stuff? Is that what you're saying?
Well, they get the list.
Mr. Chair and Senator Courtney, may I respond to that, please? Their bill, their version of this bill, allows the court to decide what happens to that information, and it has a series of limitations on what use can be made of it. The court decides whether anybody but the lawyer sees it, and in the current case in Clatsop County, the court's order was you get to look at this list solely for the purpose of examining it for representativeness. You may not give it to your client, you may not give it to anyone else, and when it's all done, you give that list back to me and you don't keep it. So to suggest that we're going to give that to our clients is completely...
Harper, that's not what I was suggesting. Senator Courtney asked why there was concern about this information going out. I didn't say that the bill didn't address that issue of it going out further, and I didn't say that it wouldn't address it. Even if your amendment were passed, the court would have the authority to limit it. The reason that we opposed the...
Okay, hang on a second. You know, me dealing with this, all of these things, including this issue, is like a hog looking at a wristwatch. So,
hog looking at a wristwatch.
Yeah, so we're going to close the hearing. I need Senator Courtney and Senator Brown to look at this thing for me, for the committee, very carefully. Senator Menace, when I find him. Maybe by close of business today, we can decide. We'll probably stick it on tomorrow's schedule or Monday's schedule, but I need... to back up a little bit, because okay. I need some expertise on this stuff. So you've heard, you know, we need to ask you more questions, or
no I may need a.
You guys understand what we're trying to talk about?
I may need a therapist. Yeah. Have to look at this okay. The way it's going.
All right. Well, let's close work session on this and open work session on 3410.
Yeah. I'm gonna go.
Let me get this bit out. Hang on. Okay.
You went over Randon?
Yeah.
Randon? I was at Randon.
You were?
Yes.
One second. We'll be down here. This is our last bill.
I guess I run back to Randon then.
No, I was going to Randy, not Radon.
Oh, Radon.
Radon.
3410. Is this good, Bill?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, it is.
Anybody complaining about it?
No, sir. It's a housekeeping bill from last session's teen graduate back.
I don't want to look totally stupid here.
Just a simple housekeeping.
Oh, yeah, I go for this. I want to carry this one, too, because you're not giving any bills. All right.
Okay,
I move House Bill 3410 to the Senate for the due pass recommendation.
Courtney moves House Bill 3410 for the due pass recommendation. Discussion, objection, hearing none. He would like to carry it.
Unless I would.
With that, we are adjourned. Thank you, Senator Brown.
I'll go back to that.